This is Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. It's Friday and time for our week in review, beginning with federal charges of obstruction of justice against a state judge and court officer. Prosecutors yesterday said Judge Shelley Richmond Joseph and now retired court officer Wesley McGregor obstructed justice when they allegedly helped a man slip out the back door of a courthouse to avoid detention by U.S. immigration authorities. Here's U.S. Attorney for Massachusetts, Andrew Lelling.
This case is not about immigration. It is about the rule of law. The allegations involve the intentional interference with federal officers in the course of their duties. That is a crime.
Yet Matthew Siegel of the Massachusetts ACLU says this is not a criminal matter.
If the federal government has an issue with how a judge is behaving, they can pick up the phone and try to talk about it.
Retired federal judge Nancy Gertner goes even further.
There could have been an injunction. There could have been a civil proceeding. Judges are rule followers. To use the criminal process this way is like using a thermonuclear device to kill a gnat.
But at his news conference yesterday, U.S. Attorney Lelling said his critics are wrong.
We did not bring this case in response to the public debate over immigration enforcement. There are reasonable arguments on both sides of that debate, but this isn't a policy seminar. It's a law enforcement action.
The judge, Shelley Richmond Joseph has been suspended without pay. Judge Joseph and former court officer Wesley McGregor are now both out on bail. And here to help us make sense of the case is Jennifer Braceras, political consultant and senior fellow for legal policy with the Independent Women's Forum. Welcome back, Jennifer.
Thank you.
Also with us this week is Michael Curry. He's the former president of the Boston chapter of the NAACP and member of the National NAACP Board of Directors. Hey there, Michael.
Hey, how are you?
All right. Let me just get your guys' initial reaction to this case. It's one that we've covered on the program before, but really went to the next level yesterday with these charges of obstruction of justice. Mm-hmm. Jennifer, what do you think about it?
Well, it's somewhat unusual, but I don't think that it's unwarranted. I think that let's suppose you had a state court judge in Texas who had a person in their courtroom for some, you know, crime or misdemeanor, felony, whatever it may be. And there was an ATF agent that was coming to arrest that person on a gun violation. And this particular state court judge, hypothetically, you know, doesn't believe somebody should be arrested for a gun violation because this is Texas, and decides to scurry the guy out the back door. I mean, people would be appalled by that, and people would regard that as obstruction of justice and would expect the federal government to do something about that. If that hypothetical state court judge had thwarted a federal officer from arresting someone on a gun charge. So I agree with U.S. Attorney Lelling that we have to look at this not as an immigration issue, but as a rule of law issue.
Interesting. So we've heard the Democratic Attorney General in our state, Maura Healey, say that Andrew Lelling, a Republican appointee, is acting with a political motive. And you're suggesting maybe the inverse is true.
Well, actually, there's a reason for that. I have sources that tell me that Attorney General Healey is preparing a lawsuit, actually, to sue the administration to prevent the state from having to cooperate with federal authorities in terms of immigration and illegal aliens. So frankly, she's the one being political. She's just mad that this issue, that by charging this judge, it makes her lawsuit, which she hasn't yet announced, look like it's reactive. So she's actually upset, in my view, for political reasons, according to my sources.
Interesting. So WBUR's newsroom, I'll just note, hasn't independently confirmed that report, but Jennifer Braceras may be breaking some news on our air. Michael Curry, how about you? What do you make of these charges?
Well, I mean, it's actually another concern that many of us have, that this president and this administration and its anti-immigrant policies is having a chilling effect and anti-access effect across systems. So healthcare, we know that people aren't going to get healthcare because they're concerned about ICE investigators and they're not getting appointments. Now we add on top of that people aren't accessing our state judicial systems potentially because now there's a concern that state government will be working with the federal government. I think ultimately I'm spot on with Maura Healey, Attorney General Maura Healey, that there has to be a separation here. There has to be a respect, a mutual respect between federal authorities and our state courts. And that didn't happen here. I think that there is a taint of politics in this. Having worked closely with our U.S. Attorney's Office in the past, and I've done that in my NAACP role, there is a mandate that comes down from D.C. on what kind of investigations and what kind of cases There is definitely an anti-immigrant mandate coming from the Trump administration. And it's unfortunate that this U.S. attorney chose this case to make as an example.
I will tell you that this prosecution in no way involved the Federal Department of Justice. They were not aware that the U.S. Attorney's Office was looking into it. This has actually been pending for a long time, almost a year, ever since it happened. The grand jury was investigating it. So this was not a rash, reactive charge. It's something they've been deliberating about on their own without the long arm of Washington telling them what to do. And this is where they came out, that this needed to be done to uphold the rule of law. But let's just take another hypothetical for just so, you know, we can sort of take it outside of the realm of immigration.
Can we do that in just one moment? I just want to add, I think, though, that the cooperation that Michael was talking about was the ICE officer who was in the courtroom, right? And that's the chilling effect
Correct.
You're worried about is what that cooperation could be, that you have a state court and a federal official there to pick him up. Go ahead, Jennifer. Sorry.
Well, state court judges cannot close the courtroom to federal officials. That in and of itself is against the law. Forget about scurrying the guy out the back door. But the hypothetical I was going to mention is, let's go back to the time of segregation. You had a lot of racist and intransigent state court judges in the South. And what if the state court judges in the South just decided that they weren't going to, you know, apply the rule of law or weren't going to abide by what, you know, the federal marshals said they had to do? That would have been absurd. And so, yes, we do have a federal system where state and federal governments have separate jurisdictions over things. But that doesn't mean that state jurisdictions can just go tell the federal government to pound sand. They still have to abide by federal law.
I'm not sure I get the equivalence in that. I think the concern here is the anti-immigrant rhetoric from this administration, and whether it was a direct from the Department of Justice or just this U.S. attorney trying to feed or satisfy this administration with a prosecution. I think you've heard from many experts here, even at the station, that this was just a disrespect to state courts. This could have been handled in a non-criminal way and should have been handled that way.
So do you think a state court official would have been within their bounds to flout Brown versus Board of Education and flout the orders of a U.S. Marshal in desegregating a school? What's the difference?
I think clearly here the issue is that the judge in this case felt like the intervention of the federal immigration authorities in this case was unwarranted and chose an action that many could argue, and I think is a valid argument.
It's not her job to decide if immigration policy is unwarranted.
You can argue whether it was appropriately mishandled, but there's a discretion that the U.S. attorney has in all of these cases, and I think we've debated that even on these shows. That discretion can be abused, and I think this U.S. attorney abused that discretion in this case.
Well, let me just interject one additional factor that I think is a complicating one in this case, which is the original reason that this undocumented immigrant was picked up in the first place, as we understand it, was that Newton police ran his license plate through their database and saw that he was wanted for a DUI in another state. But when he came before the court, Judge Joseph determined that the mugshot didn't actually match the man before her in court. And so she apparently had some concern about whether he had been arrested on false pretenses in the first place, and that therefore it would be unfair for ICE to be able to catch him. And when we talked to former federal judge Nancy Gertner about this yesterday, she said, you know, maybe Judge Joseph could have handled things better. She recalled the similar case of mistaken identity in her court, where she just kind of froze the proceedings until it could be determined clearly whether this was the right person in front of her. But what about that argument, Jennifer Braceras?
This judge deliberately went off the record in order to hide what she was doing.
She shut off the courtroom recording for roughly a minute, which is against protocol.
Right.
Although typically judges aren't indicted for that, though, right?
No, of course not. But then she went and lied to all of her senior colleagues about what she had done. I mean, the intent, in my view, was clear. She was subverting federal law, and she intended to hide it. And, you know, I just think because she is a judge, it's actually worse what she did than if, for example, you know, a private citizen were to harbor an illegal immigrant or a church official, for example. She is an officer of the court. Her job is to uphold the rule of law. That applies whether she agrees with the law, whether she thinks the law is fair, whether she thinks the law is unfair. There are a lot of federal laws that may not be fair. There are some people who believe strict federal restrictions on gun ownership are unfair. But would that give, in my hypothetical, you know, a Texas state court judge the right to scurry someone out the back door and avoid capture by the ATF. Absolutely not.
I just point out, we did hear from Governor Charlie Baker on this matter this week as well. He was talking with Channel 7. And I'll just point out, too, that he's not someone who has always agreed with the president, even though he is a Republican. But he does sound a little bit more like he's toeing the line on this one.
Nobody's above the law. And in this particular case, there were issues that were raised that deserve to be investigated. And I believe at the end of the day, this will be decided by the federal courts.
So what about that, Michael Curry? I mean, I think even a lot of Democrats in the state would say, you know, they've generally found Charlie Baker to be a very, you know, sober-minded, clear thinker on issues like this. And yet he seems to think that Andrew Lelling has a case here.
Yeah, I don't think I'm surprised by Governor Baker's position. I think he would. This is a predictable position for him. I think the challenge, though, and if I were speaking to the governor, is when do you use a criminal process to go after a state court judge using their discretion? There's a lot of discretion in our judicial system. And ultimately, you can question whether she used the best discretion. I think it's a valid argument. But I don't think a criminal prosecution was warranted. And it's a disrespect for our state judicial system, our state court system, to have brought a case against this judge and that court officer.
So the discretion point is an interesting one, but because we don't know what went on behind the scenes, I think it's unfair to speculate. And what we do know is that this investigation has been going on for almost a year. We don't know. We do know that the U.S. attorney was in touch with her lawyer. And so we don't know what they had been negotiating during that time, what may have been offered to her to resolve it differently. We have no idea. So I think it's unfair to speculate and to act as though this was an unfair use of discretion, because it may be that there were other options on the table. And for whatever reason, things didn't go the judge's way. We don't have that information. And until we do, I think it's unfair to say that the U.S. attorney used his discretion unfairly.
In the scheme of everything that we need our U.S. attorney to focus on, this is not one of those.
We're rounding up the week in news with Jennifer Braceras, political consultant and senior fellow for legal policy with the Independent Women's Forum, and Michael Curry, former president of the Boston branch of the NAACP and a member of the National NAACP Board of Directors. And while I have you both, I do want to get to another topic for the week, which is the ever-growing 2020 field of presidential candidates. We're up to 20 Democrats in the race right now that we can officially include former Vice President Joe Biden, who has immediately looked beyond the primary and taken aim at the president.
We give Donald Trump 8 years in the White House, he will forever and fundamentally alter the character of this nation, who we are. And I cannot stand by and watch that happen.
Also this week, Massachusetts Congressman Seth Moulton tossed his hat into the ring. And on WBUR's Morning Edition, he said he's not worried about his high-profile failed effort to oust Nancy Pelosi as Speaker of the House. In fact, he says he's proud to not be an establishment candidate.
That's not what people want, especially in the districts that we have to win to defeat Trump. It'll make me a stronger nominee that I've proven that I'm willing to take on the Washington establishment.
You buy that, Jennifer Braceras? What do you think about Seth Moulton? Does he have a shot here? Is he just the man to take on the president?
So he absolutely would have a shot in the general. The question is whether he gets through this very large and turbulent primary. He's a relative unknown. But I do think that if the Democrats want to win in 2020, they would be wise to look very, very carefully at Seth Moulton. He is positive. He is a patriot. 4 tours of duty in Iraq. He has wide crossover appeal. The fact that he challenged Nancy Pelosi is a plus to independent voters and even to, you know, young progressive voters who feel that maybe their concerns aren't being heard by the establishment. None of those are negative things. His challenge will be name recognition in the primary and just getting through the minefield that, you know, the next 12, 24 months, whatever it is. I don't know how many months it is.
A long time still.
Right. The minefield that awaits.
And, you know, there is some question, though, about how just crowded this field is and how it is hard to stand out. You know, when we at WBUR spoke with the Democratic political consultant Scott Fersen, who worked on Moulton's first campaign for Congress, even Fersen said, you know, the lane that Moulton would be running in is already getting crowded.
When Seth shows up for the presidential race, he's going to find that Pete Buttigieg is standing in his lane. Buttigieg is a veteran. He's got some good policy chops, very, very smart, same kind of pedigree from a better part of the country, I think, for Democrats. And frankly, he's generated a ton of excitement.
Buttigieg, of course, the mayor of South Bend, Indiana, so more of a swing state than what we have out here. Yeah. And so how about that, Michael Curry? I mean, does Scott Fersen have a point there?
Yeah, I think he does. I think, quite frankly, 20 candidates is a lot of candidates to run. But as a Democrat, I'm excited that there's a large field with diverse perspectives. I think there'll be a little bit of tripping over each other's shoes to figure out who is the ideal candidate. I think people want a stark difference from the president we have. They want them to be tough, someone who can come back with the quips and the retorts to this president, but at the same time have a vision for the future. I don't know if Moulton is, at least in my conversation with other Democrats, is one that people are paying much attention to. And quite frankly, I think he has some work to do, not just to differentiate himself, but to make a case for why he should be the candidate. It is an uphill climb for him.
All right, let's talk about Biden a little bit. He is the latest entry to the race. He officially got in yesterday. And for whatever polls are worth at this stage, Morning Consult and Politico give him an 8-point edge in their latest survey if he were head-to-head against President Trump, although that doesn't necessarily mean he can get out of the primary. But he also is facing controversy right away for not directly apologizing to Anita Hill for the way he handled the 1991 Clarence Thomas hearings. His campaign disclosed earlier this week that he did call Hill and express his, quote, regret for what she endured. Hill, who is now a professor at Brandeis, then told the New York Times that she was unsatisfied with that call, didn't think he maybe took full responsibility. And Biden sort of answered some of these questions in his first interview on television today. Here he is talking with Joy Behar on ABC's The View.
You know, I think what she wants you to say is, I'm sorry for the way I treated you, not for the way you were treated. I think that might be closer.
Well, but I'm sorry the way she got treated. In terms of, I never heard say, if you go back and look what I said and didn't say, I don't think I treated her badly.
So how about that, Jennifer? I mean, he's choosing his words carefully there. He's saying, sorry this happened to you. He's not saying, I'm sorry for what I did.
I guess you'd have to tell me specifically what it is you think Biden did to Anita Hill that was so offensive. He was on the side that was opposed to Clarence Thomas. So what exactly was the problem?
Well, the argument would be that he was in charge of the Judiciary Committee.
Yeah, I get the argument.
And that he didn't call corroborating witnesses.
Right.
So that would be, that in theory, that's what he ought to apologize for. That's what his critics
say. Yeah, I don't think that, I don't want to get into Clarence Thomas and Anita Hill. I have strong views about that. And I certainly don't think that as a member of the party that was dragging Clarence Thomas's name through the mud, that Joe Biden has anything to apologize to Anita Hill for. I'd like to see him apologize to Clarence Thomas, actually, but that's a whole nother story. As a political analyst, I would simply say that I don't think that most of today's younger voters remember that, care about it. Joe Biden has other issues with the younger electorate than that, but he does have the name recognition, and he does have a lot of positives that could help him in a general election. And so we'll see what happens. But I don't think that's a big issue for him, no.
I'm reminded, though, that Clarence Thomas during those hearings, Michael Curry, referred to that confirmation hearing as a circus and as a lynching.
A high-tech lynching.
And as Biden takes criticism for not being sensitive enough to Anita Hill in some people's estimation, he might counter that he was trying to be sensitive to Thomas because there's a long history of sham justice for black men in this country. So do you cut any slack to Biden?
No, I mean, I was offended even with the reference to a high-tech lynching. I think that this was really Biden's failure, and I think he's increasingly starting to acknowledge that as a person who had some sway in the process of the hearing. There should have been corroborating witnesses called, and I think he does owe an apology directly to Anita Hill for his part in that hearing. Ultimately, you can oppose the candidate, and at that time, Clarence Thomas, but still have flaws in how the hearing was dealt. We know that we would not deal with a woman today like we did then. We know that a congressional hearing would not take place the same way, and we've just gone through that.
With Kavanaugh.
With Kavanaugh. Biden. So the reality is, I think Biden's in a situation where he can fight this and really hurt his campaign, or in a heightened awareness, because I disagree with Jennifer. There is that young generation I talk to and train in my classes and in other settings. They're becoming students of history. So they're actually looking back at these cases and saying, what kind of a person were you when you were in these other roles? And do you deserve my vote? He'll have to answer to them.
As we were coming on the air today, Biden's campaign was touting his $6.3 million fundraising total in the first 24 hours. That surpasses Beto O'Rourke and Bernie Sanders, who had previously had the highs, so it doesn't seem to be hurting him, at least by that measure. I do want to point out, too, that at a rally in Iowa yesterday, another one of our presidential candidates, Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren, went after Joe Biden, but on a different front. She attacked his work in the past on bankruptcy laws.
At a time when the biggest financial institutions in this country were trying to put the squeeze on millions of hardworking families, there was nobody to stand up for them. I got in that fight because they just didn't have anyone. And Joe Biden was on the side of the credit card companies.
So what do you think, Jennifer Braceras? Is that a more effective, make it a more of a policy critique than going after, any of his personal characteristics?
That may be, in a Democratic primary, a more effective approach, since primaries are usually fought on policy and ideology, and they draw the most ideological voters. But I try to look at this as a political analyst, and I try to take myself out of, my partisan role and say, which of these candidates has the best chance in a general election of winning independent voters in Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan, West Virginia, the states Hillary lost to Donald Trump? And the answer is Joe Biden has a better chance than Elizabeth Warren in those states. I also believe that Seth Moulton would have a good chance in those states. But a lot of voters, as Bill Clinton used to say, Democrats want to fall in love with their candidates, right? And they want ideological purity. But ideological purity means nothing if you can't win. And from a political perspective, I don't think Elizabeth Warren has a chance.
Last word to you, Michael Curry. She's running a very policy-heavy campaign right from the get-go. Is that the winning strategy?
Yeah, I think Democrats want something bold. They want a candidate that's bringing a bold vision, that's willing to talk about free public education on the college level, that's willing to talking about going after for-profit college institutions, at least not giving them the financial boost, the subsidies that they may get. There is a need to have bold vision, and I think Senator Warren has always delivered that. I'm not convinced that we know now who could win. If we didn't learn anything else from Donald Trump, is that all the pundits were wrong. That quite frankly, if you get a candidate that's willing to challenge the authority.
I wasn't. I called that one in February of 2016.
You were one of the few.
There's evidence to prove it.
And I think that the same thing could happen on the Democratic side. I think Senator Warren, her message is strong. It's sharp. And people know she cares. I think that authenticity that she brings to this debate is going to be refreshing.
Authenticity with her light beer on New Year's Eve? That wasn't perceived as very authentic.
Well, I'm very fortunate to know her well. And on healthcare issues and many other issues, she's an authentic person who I'm excited is in the race.
That's Michael Curry, former president of the Boston chapter of the NAACP and member of the National NAACP Board of Directors. Michael, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
And Jennifer Braceras, political consultant and senior fellow for legal policy with the Independent Women's Forum. Thanks to you as well.
Thank you.